Well, with typical Trump style, chutzpah, big noting himself, bragging maybe even a little, he's made a rather significant announcement.
This is a very special day, maybe unprecedented in many ways. It is unprecedented. But thank you all, and thank you all to those great countries that helped. We were given a tremendous amount of help. Everybody was unified in wanting this war to end and seeing peace in the Middle East. And we're very close to achieving that. Thank you all, and everybody will be treated fairly.
Everybody will be treated fairly, Geraldine. It's a pretty big claim.
Yes, and the question is that a sufficient circuit breaker to stop these terrible events? Now, we're going to do a special episode here on Global Roaming. I'm on my phone in Melbourne Airport. I've been down in Melbourne. Hamish, you're on your phone in the middle of Vietnam.
Yeah, I am, Geraldine. Another country that's found itself dealing with the United States on both geopolitical and real estate terms as they've been trying to negotiate their way out of the 46% tariffs. Eric Trump's been here making plans for a big Trump Tower and a Trump golf course worth billions of dollars. So I guess we're seeing echoes of that in everything that's being spoken about in relation to Gaza as well, Geraldine. The critical reason, though, that we are talking right now is that Hamas has indicated that it will move to release the remaining hostages, both those that are dead and those that are alive. And Israel has been told by Donald Trump to stop the bombing now. It doesn't look like they have actually stopped. There's still some bombing going on, but it does appear that the Israelis are moving to reduce the scale of their offensive on Gaza City as part of this, what would be a staged withdrawal, if at all, goes ahead.
Well, look, I thought myself, I said to our producer, Taryn, I think that Hamas is actually backed into a corner it hasn't quite been in. And I think that they will put conditions on, it'll be a conditional approval, so that it won't look like a complete surrender. And I think particularly what will be very, very interesting to watch in from now on in is just what they seek, because I think they'll probably seek, for instance, a faster withdrawal of the IDF to a buffer zone right on the edge with Egypt. So I think that'll be one of the things that the Hamas people go for, just so that gives them a bit more dignity. I also think the key thing I'm looking out for is how you get the men of violence to lay down their arms, which is where I think Tony Blair, who's a name we haven't yet introduced into the picture, is just such a fascinating part of this whole story, because that's exactly what was one of the great demands when he was doing the Northern Ireland Peace Accords, is how you get the people who are used to violence to say, no, we've got to stop it.
Yeah, I do want to get to the Tony Blair stuff, because I think that's a really important dimension to all of this. I've just been reading, he's been working with Jared Kushner, who is Trump's son-in-law, was the Trump administration's Middle East envoy during the first term. Earlier this year, he started working with Blair and the Blair Institute on some of these proposals, not all of which are included in this 20-point plan, but some of them are. He's been central, as I'm reading in the New York Times today, to how this has unfolded. I think it's interesting just noting what you were saying about the Hamas reaction, Geraldine. Steve Witkoff has started changing his language around the surrender of weapons. They're now using this term decommissioning of weapons. So that's an interesting rhetorical shift that we're seeing here, and perhaps gives us a clue of what's to come. I think the Hamas statement in response is also worth reading and looking at closely. And I've also even noticed some of the translations of it vary slightly, because some of them seem to say that Hamas wants a unanimous Palestinian position on the way forward in terms of self-governance, etc. But other translations seem to use the term comprehensive. Those are two, in my mind, quite different things and offer a different space, I guess. And sometimes in negotiations, you will see this happen. They will create deliberate ambiguity, and sometimes the ambiguity exists in the translations to enable a way forward so that the various parties can take what they want out of it and sell it to their own people and stakeholders. I think the other thing is that in the Hamas statement, they talk about Hamas having a role ongoing in dealing with the Palestinian side of things in terms of etching out whatever happens next. Now, that's contrary to what all of these Western nations, which are saying they want to recognize Palestinian statehood, have indicated they would accept. But I think that's where the Tony Blair piece of the puzzle gets really interesting, because if you look at everything he has ever said about Northern Ireland, it's all about bringing the parties in, dealing them into the peace settlement. That's what they did in Northern Ireland. Yes. They did look at economic development. They did look at a political settlement. And you know, certainly if there's, you know, people will have their views about Tony Blair because of Iraq and all the rest of it. But if there's some kind of template there in his mind about the way you bring about peace in intractable conflicts, clearly there's some lessons to be learned about what they did in Northern Ireland.
Look, I don't think the Israelis will ever agree to Hamas being involved, but there are all sorts of weasel ways around this. It's possible, I think. I mean, I'm just guessing here, again, based on how you end these things. I mean, you don't end shocking wars in gorgeous, beautiful peace agreements where there's overt justice everywhere. That's not how they end. You know, if you think of World War II, it wasn't until Hitler committed suicide and the generals then did an unconditional surrender, where they basically said, so did the Japanese at the end of World War II. So unconditional surrenders are one thing. Conditional surrenders, where you're suing for terms, are another altogether. That's where you get into the art of persuasion and you get into negotiation. Now, I suspect there may be, like, the whole talk about bringing a technocratic Palestinian presence in, I think is very, very interesting. I mean, one of the sort of faults of this peace plan that Trump outlined was that there was no overt perceived Palestinian involvement in it. But there was very definite talk about the need for a technocratic Palestinian government or group of governors, as it were. Now, that is something I have myself heard in the West Bank. Like, there is a real sense that there are quite a lot of very talented Palestinians who won't have a bar of politics because they think it's grubby. And funnily enough, I've actually said to several of them, well, how do you think you're going to change anything if you think it's too grubby to enter the picture? So if people like Blair and Kushner are smart, they'll draw those people in. And actually, then you might even have, it seems to me, the possibility that if those Hamas people are prepared, if to lay down their arms, they could have a period of being outside the process and reform as something different. Like, I'm absolutely, this is years ahead I'm looking at. I just can't see the Israelis, none of them, like not just Netanyahu and the people around him, but people like Yair Lapid and so on, agreeing to any Hamas presence at the moment.
And I guess maybe it's worth actually just bring listeners up to speed with what exactly the proposal is now. So there's this sort of two-tiered structure that is being put forward as part of this 20-point plan. One is a so-called Board of Peace, which would be chaired by Donald Trump. This is where Tony Blair would play a role. He would be on this board. Interestingly, I don't know if you read the 20-point plan, Geraldine, but they point to other world leaders yet to be announced also being placed on this board. And that would provide a layer of oversight above this technocratic Palestinian government structure, which would be responsible for the administration. There'd also be this separate body called the ISF, the International Stabilization Force, made up of Arab states and other military forces, which would take the place of the IDF as it withdraws. So you'd have to imagine that this would be some of the Emirates, perhaps, maybe the Jordanians or Egyptians. But obviously, I think in the past, Anthony Albanese has said that Australia would be open to playing some sort of limited role. So it'd be interesting to see what the ISF actually turns out to be, International Stabilization Force. I also wanted to introduce something here, Geraldine, that you might have seen some months ago when it was released. And I think the whole world was kind of agog at the brazenness of it. It was this AI-generated Trump Gaza future video. Let's just hear a little bit of it to remind ourselves.
Donald's coming to set you free, bringing the light for all to see. No more tunnels, no more fear. Trump Gaza is finally here. Trump Gaza shining bright, golden future, a brand new life. Feast and dance, the deal is done. Trump Gaza, number feast and dance, the deal is done. Trump Gaza, number one.
Did you see it at the time, Jerry? Do you remember watching it?
No, I didn't, Hamish, no.
It's absolutely nuts, this sort of, you know, vision of Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu sunbaking and dollars raining out of the sky to happy Palestinian children and a sort of Emirati-style city emerging out of the rubble of Gaza. Now, I think at the time it was like, wow, this is just insane. But there's actually elements of the 20-point peace plan that I think really reflect that vision quite strongly. Now, there's details in the 20-point plan. By the way, it was originally a 21-point plan. I'm so curious about what the 21st point was and how that came to not be there any longer. But some of the 20 points read very much like detailed, experienced diplomatic negotiating points laid out by some of these involved in the talks in Qatar. But others then read like something that have sort of been added on once they've returned to Trump to ask him for his point of view on it all. I want to read you a bit of point 10, Geraldine, because I just think the language is so Trumpian. Point 10. A Trump economic development plan to rebuild and energize Gaza will be created by convening a panel of experts who have helped birth some of the thriving modern miracle cities of the Middle East. Many thoughtful investment proposals, exciting development ideas have been crafted by well-meaning international groups and will be considered to synthesize the security and governance frameworks to attract and facilitate these investments that will create jobs, opportunity, and hopes for future Gaza. By the way, the next point, 11, is a special economic zone established with preferred tariff and access rates to be negotiated with participating countries. So you can see there the way Trump does business.
Well, you see, yes, but you see, I think that's absolutely fascinating and actually gives one hope about what you even speak to the local Palestinians, because we've done programs on this where we've learned that there are the Palestinian diaspora around the world is ready, I hear, to stump up money. They're very successful, a lot of them, in both the UK and particularly even in Australia and in America. And so if they feel that there is some staged process, that panel, to actually suggest that there is a staged process. See, I think it might attract. I don't think that's fanciful. God help it. I hope it attracts money for jobs. It, of course, that's got to attract, you know, rebuilds. But the fact that that is even being articulated, I mean, this is the sort of thing that I think Henry Kissinger would have also presided over. Like, that was what people said about Kissinger's diplomacy in the Middle East. It took a long time. It inched forward incrementally. There was masses of forward and back and forward and back, but he stuck with it. And I suspect that that is what Blair has done.
What do you make of the involvement of Tony Blair? There's obviously been huge reaction, particularly in the Arab world, given what happened in Iraq and Blair's role there. What do you make of his involvement here?
So I have to confess I don't understand that reaction. Blair has been working on this. I think he was at the invitation of Clinton when he was Prime Minister. He started working on Palestinian issues. He was involved in the Quartet, which was the four-part sort of great power, as it were, involvement in trying to get solutions way back in the 90s and right through the noughties. He has stayed on this for many, many years. And as I read it, he... after October the 7th, 2023, he started working intensively on something like this. Like, this hasn't just appeared overnight. This has been, and that's why it actually does give me a bit of hope, because I think it has been steadily put forward. And, you know, we've all think, oh, will anything work? But to me, it has got something about it that might be, and, you know, tragically, a lot of people have lost their lives in the meantime. But look, I think Blair... my suspicion is that the greatest opposition to Blair will be in the West, because people do care to remember his involvement in the weapons of mass destruction. I can't imagine the Arab world will be nearly as sceptical, because they're used to big men coming back and forward. They don't necessarily expect people to make no mistakes. Blair made mistakes. He's admitted it. But he is obviously, he's got a lot of energy. he's now got this very substantial Blair Institute behind him. I think, you know, for Blair, in its own way, it is a chance to redeem himself in the eyes of a lot of his own compatriots, that he will dedicate himself and throw himself into it and try to achieve something that others haven't been able to achieve. I don't think he's an egoist like Trump. He's an egoist, of course. He's got a big ego. But I actually think Blair has a lot of potential to preside pretty well.
I'm not sure it will be viewed quite as generously in the Arab world as what you are describing there. I think there are long memories, and there's certainly recent memories of, you know, all the civilians that have died in Iraq since the invasion. I think people do remember the way in which the war came about, the way in which international instruments, the United Nations, were used by Blair and Bush to justify the war. I think that has, in the eyes of many in the Arab world, discredited him, rightly or wrongly. You know, I understand there are different views on this. But I'm not sure it's just as simple as saying, well, they're used to strongmen or people with strong ideas coming in and making mistakes and then moving forward. Clearly, whatever happens for the Palestinian people will need to have currency. It will need to have social license. It will need to have, you know, at least enough of the Palestinian people believing in whatever that idea is in order for it to move forward. And you know, this is...
Yes, but he, sorry to interrupt you, but look, I couldn't agree with you more. They are the ones who weren't included, as I say, in the overt negotiations around this, which was the flaw in the ointment, as it were. But, you know, there's so many of them want it to be solved because they want to move on. They're desperate to get things onto some sort of better road. And anybody who can achieve that, I think, will get at least their overt blessing. What they think about underneath, it might be another matter. But there's a lot of people in the Arab world that want this settled in some form that gives them the Palestinians dignity.
It's just a question, though, of whether dignity comes when it's imposed by Western men. Western men like Tony Blair that tried to do that in Iraq, and we all saw what the consequences of that was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been waiting to hear from the Arab world in this ghastly 2 years. I've been waiting to hear leadership from the Arab world, and I haven't heard it. I've heard small, you know, they've gathered to get together to talk about the possibility, as they, you know, what they would essentially agree to, but they haven't really shown leadership, which is why I think this is so important that they're prepared to put their own soldiers in the field and in that international stabilization force. Because, I mean, one assumes that there are going to be fighters pop their heads up out of the tunnels who'll take pot shots at Emirati soldiers and Saudi soldiers. Goodness me. That's a very interesting new development.
Look, I don't mean to get into a tangle about this, but I think that somewhat selective description of the role of the Arabs over the last 2 years misses the fact that the Qataris, we would not be here without the role of the Qataris. You might well criticise them for not always putting their money where their mouth is in terms of genuine offers of support to the Palestinians, but I don't think it can be said truthfully that Arab states haven't played any leadership role in trying to bring this all to a close. What about the Israeli domestic political play here, Geraldine? Because, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, look, he's sort of making some of the right noises. Will he move forward with all of this? I think it's very difficult to say.
I think it's very difficult to say, and I think he is... Look, he won't like this, let's face it, and nor will his two particular ministers, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. But as I heard it during the week, which is why I thought the thing had a chance, somebody had worked out, and I'd love to know who the sort of political thinkers were, They got the support of other groups so that the government wouldn't fall, because Mottridge and Ben-Gavir did their usual, we'll pull out and the government will fall. But it was clear the government wasn't going to fall during this period of considering the peace deal. I think that, it's clear, Netanyahu will never agree to a Palestinian state, but he won't be on the stage forever. And I think that Yair Lapid, the opposition, one of the opposition leaders, has put out a statement, hasn't he, today, saying to let the world know that the political community in Israel is behind where Netanyahu is right now in terms of agreeing to the initial negotiations. So it was carefully worded, I thought. Clearly, the Israeli people are desperate to get the hostages home. And, of course, the people of Gaza, I think, will just be totally desperate for the guns to stop.
Mm. There's a really fantastic piece in the New York Times, which we're going to put into the show notes, Geraldine. If you're listening and you want a bit more detail on sort of how the US has leveraged and pushed Netanyahu on this, it goes into great detail about how the strikes in Qatar by the Israelis to try and take out those Hamas negotiators, which really failed, they didn't hit their intended targets, how that was used by the Americans to leverage this moment. There was a sort of forced apology from Netanyahu to the Qataris, an amazing photograph of Netanyahu in the White House with Trump, the phone sitting on Trump's lap quite awkwardly, with Netanyahu on the receiver, delivering his own handwritten apology to the Qataris. It's quite extraordinary, and I think it's really interesting to see the way that Jared Kushner and Witkoff, with Trump on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly recently, started to push Netanyahu towards this, in part because of the international fury at Israel's strikes in Qatar on those negotiators. Shall we wrap it up there, Geraldine, and look forward to chatting in the main episode later this week?
Indeed, and lots more will emerge. I mean, it really is a vital development. Let's hope. That it does bring the guns quiet and people have a chance to get back to some sort of normal life. So see you next week back in Australia, Hamish.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye.